Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Oh. Welcome, everyone. I'm Angelia Leung, chair of this Department of World Arts and Cultures in Dance, and I'm very, very happy to welcome all of you and our wonderful participants of this event today. I'll be very brief, as I know there's a very full program before you in both performance and in panel presentations. I'm very pleased to present and introduce Judy Matoma, who spearheaded much of this. She's the director of the Center for Intercultural Performance here in the department, and Maritime professor in dance, as well as former chair of this department. And her interest in the Pacific, particularly with these islands, began with her initial visit back in 1980 during the Festival of the Pacific Arts in Papua New Guinea when she was a graduate student at the University of Hawaii. And now here we are with a 14-city tour with these wonderful dancers and singers, as well as the collaboration with the Institute for Environment and Sustainability. It's really great to have science and art coming together. I'm also pleased to introduce Madeline Glickfeld, who is substituting for Glenn McDonough, who unfortunately took ill today. But Madeline will also speak briefly, and she's the Assistant Director of Outreach and Strategic Initiatives there at the Institute. So without further ado, Judy and Madeline.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm here to give you my Glenn's apologies. He couldn't be here, but it's my benefit because I get to stand here with Judy. And I'm very excited. The Institute is very excited to have been invited to co-host this wonderful group, this company of nations. And we're also very excited to have the opportunity to have our faculty and our government participate in dialogue and performance with them. So with that, I just want to thank Judy for all of the work that she's done to bring this company here, and thank the company, and welcome to Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
So Madeline and Fiona and everybody at the Institute have been so conscientious about putting today's program together. I'm happy that it demonstrates what the power of educational outreach and policy decisions might be in a project of the arts. Water is Rising is a project that is now, this is our first public event. We are probably going to do 40 public events in the course of 43 days. So I'm happy that the very first event is in my own building under my own Department of World Arts and Cultures, and with my center staff right downstairs at their computers close at hand. We are very eager that the project Water is Rising have a larger impact than just a performing arts tour. Not that that isn't important. Certainly my life is dedicated to that. But to be able to bring to the forefront a major concern of international concern through the arts, through the humanity of people who are living in these very difficult circumstances in Central Pacific. So today we have, as you can tell, this great program. I hope if you don't have a program, they are up here. It will help you get through the kind of wonderful arc of activity that we have planned for you today. We're starting out. I guess I should also say, Water is Rising is bringing 36 artists from the countries of Kiribati, Tokelau, and Tuvalu. These are our very unique coral atoll situations, very isolated islands, very homogeneous communities that have lived 1,500 years together with a great opportunity to develop a cultural perspective that is, I think, unique. In fact, I was waking up this morning and I thought to myself, here we are talking with and being with people who have cultivated a way of life in a very difficult circumstance, which are these coral atolls. And the courage, the collective ethos that they have, the Inati system, for example, the sharing within the community, are things that virtually are hard to find on this planet. In fact, you might argue this is the one place where the culture of sharing, the culture of collective unity is still very alive, and it's because of their way of life. This makes the climate change discussion even more important than ever, because it's as though we have people who have a treasured knowledge of how to live together in peace, who, if they have to leave their islands, will be dispersed across the world and will no doubt lose their own culture in the process. So our first section of this afternoon is called A Dialogue of Nations, and I'm going to turn right now over to Mary Nichols, who is a very, very honored guest. Mary is coming to us from Sacramento. She is at the forefront of climate change policy. She is a warrior, no doubt, and I am very pleased that she made the effort to come here today, and she is going to host the Dialogue of Nations, which will have leaders from each of our three groups. And but first, let me have our group leaders come down and take a seat, and happy to introduce to you Mary Nichols.
Thank you very much. Could we have the other participants come to the table, please? I'm going to apologize in advance for mispronouncing names, because this is the first time that I've tried to say everybody's name out loud, but I'm very honored to be here with all of you representing your countries. I want to just start out by saying a word about the performance that we just saw, which I believe was a blessing for us, and there's only one word I recognize, which is the word alleluia. I got that one. So can someone say a few words about what you were singing? Can someone explain that?
You know the song we just sing is about the resurrection of our Savior Jesus Christ. Yeah. It's all about the resurrection.
And everyone was smiling and seemed to be enjoying themselves.
Yes,
it was
yes.
a very happy song because it's like an Easter song.
Yes,
it's like a rising song. But rising isn't always good, is it? Sometimes when we're talking about water, that's really not what we want to hear about. So I'm going to just let you all begin with your, because I know you have some remarks that you prepared. Let you begin, and then maybe I'll chime in at the end, unless I just feel like I have a burning need to ask a question, then I might stop you. But we'll start with Mr. Michaele Maiava. That's you.
Usually,
I turned it off, so there we go.
Testing.
Yeah, done.
Usually my older brother speak before the younger brother. But since I have the floor now, I'll take the floor. Thank you. This trip has been a long, long, lots of rest. It's been a long trip coming to America. We take a 40 hours boat from Tokelau to Samoa, and it takes another 2 hours to Fiji by plane, and then it takes another 10 hours to Los Angeles. So the total travel, it takes us about 3 weeks to come here to this beautiful land. Together with the brothers and sisters from Kiribati and Tuvalu, we share the same concern. And that concern's addressed with this project that was what Judy and her team worked hard to succeed. We're here with a simple message, I think. To us, it's very simple, maybe not to the scientists. But you all know that in my island, the tallest point of the island is the tallest coconut tree. It's not the tallest building. So when we have cyclones or hurricanes, the wave comes from one side, right through the villages where the people stay, goes to the lagoon side. And over the years, in the especially the past 5 to 10 years, the size, the width of the island is growing smaller, smaller and smaller. I'm sure you have seen, some of you might have seen the film by Tuvalu, about Tuvalu last night. Tokelau is pretty much the same. And it's a big concern to us. We are people of the land. We love our land. We have the land and the culture. That's what our ancestors left for us. Losing a home, I can assure you, is not the same as losing a land. Losing land is losing culture, losing your identity, losing most everything that is dear to you. It is our hope that the world, especially the developed countries, will actually realize after this tour and seeing the human face to climate change. These are my people. They represent the people of Tokelau that facing the effect of climate change. We all know the science of it. They say that it's because of so much carbon dioxide in the air, the emissions rate, China, USA, Europe are all doing a relay of who's doing going up and up. While they're doing and polluting the air, beautiful people like us, like you, will have no home soon after 50 years. So we're here with a very strong message. Help us while you're helping yourself. And thank you again for the opportunity. I will give it back to my brothers.
Thank you very much. So next on the program is Mr. Francis Tabau.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to acknowledge the Water is Rising team and Professor Judy and the team for giving us this great opportunity to share with you some of the problems regarding the effects of climate change in our country, in our island. First of all, we all know that in my country, I know that climate change is not it's not going away. It is true, and it is happening. And this causes many problems, just like the land erosion and the well that we used to drink in my country is not good. In some other parts of the islands, it's too salty, so you cannot drink from the well water. So the not only that, but the just like the used to live in our land and. In my country, the land is very important, and this is because in my country, our ancestors died for our land. They spilled many bloods for our land. So this is a great relation to us and to our land. We don't want to lose our land. We really love our land. So our message here is to you, especially big countries like the developed countries like the America. And, so because this is our only hope, I guess. And so we ask them to, so we ask you to please go for, you know, the, like renewable energies, like the wind and the sun, and you know, the, like that. And another one is to, that if you could reduce your the use of the greenhouse gases, just like the, you know, the ones that breaks the ozone layer, and we could, if you do this, we hope you will have a chance to live in our country. So the lastly and most importantly, I'll tell you again that we don't want to leave our land. We want to stay there, and if we lost our land, then just like the my brother from Tagalog says, that we lose everything, our culture, the skills that we have, everything we will lost if we lose this island of ours. So thank you very much. That's it.
Thank you. I'll pass the microphone now to Mr. Andrew Semele, and then we'll finish up.
Momo wa fata alo fatu kia goto katoa. Koma fai o kau fata si tato iti aso tenei. First of all, I would like to thank Judy and the team for bringing us here. When we talk about climate change, the background of it is the life of the people. And life of the people is an important thing in the world, and especially in small countries like Tuvalu, Tokelau, and Kiribati. So thank you, Judy, for giving us a hope to send a message to the rest of the world and the people of the United States. Thank you very much. My people, please, could you give a big hand to Judy and the team? Talking about climate change, when I talk about climate change, it brings me tears. It makes my tears fall every time. Because I'm not quite sure what happened to the life of my people in 50 years' time. It might be underwater, or it might be they call as refugees of climate change. But we don't want to do that. We don't want that to happen to our people. We don't want our people to call as refugees of climate change. We love our land. We love our tradition, our cultures. For those of you who watched the film last night about Tuvalu, and that's Tuvalu. That's the real situation faced with the Tuvaluans. The landmass is only 24 square kilometers. We have a very big ocean and very small landmass. We have no mountains that give us hope when it comes to sea level rise. Where should we run to hide ourselves when it comes to sea level rise? When sea level comes up, where should we run to? As what my brother said from Tokelau, the tallest part of Tokelau is a coconut tree. And the same case with Tuvalu. The tallest part of Tuvalu is a coconut tree, the tallest coconut tree. Tuvalu is 3 to 4 meters above sea level. And that gives us no hope when we talk about climate change and sea level rise. We have faced a lot of impact. There are lots of impacts. The effect of climate change to Tuvalu, we have faced or we have witnessed in face to face. This is the human face of those who are vulnerable to climate change. Our economy was affected. There is only one industry in Tuvalu, and that's fisheries. And we rely most on tuna, exporting tuna to the rest of the world. And what happens? What happened now? We cannot find tuna in our water. There's not much tuna in our water as before. Because we have, our water was quite hot at the moment, and the tuna they need, or they have to live in a cold water. Food security. The land was so poor, the soil was so poor at the moment, full of salt because of the sea level. As we speak now, as I speak now, people of Tuvalu run away or run around to get some water from somewhere. I know that you're already aware about the droughts in Tuvalu. Our people are now suffering and they're looking for water in order for them to survive. And what's this? These are all the results of climate change, the effects of climate change. The pollution we commit to the atmosphere, it's 0.00000, almost nothing. And the end of it, we are the people who suffer. Developed countries and developed countries are the one who are damaging the atmosphere and the ozone layer. And the people who suffered, it's me and my people. That's why it makes me tears. It makes me cry. Because I love my people. I love my land. When it comes to clean tides, there is no motorcycle. It should be run on the runway or even the road. The road was full of seawater, up to 0.5 meter or 1 meter high above from the land. If you stand in the middle of the road and you throw a stone to the other side, to the ocean side, you can throw the stone. If you turn to the ocean side and throw a stone, you can throw the stone to the ocean. And that's how big we are. Imagine there is a big wave comes and hit us. Would you be able to assist us? In that very short moment, these are the concerns of our people, of my people, and the people from Kiribati, and the people of Tokelau. Even though the trip to America takes a long way to go, and we make an effort to paddle our canoe right from the Pacific Ocean to your ocean, just for you to hear our voice, my brothers and sisters. Just for you to know how vulnerable we are. Just for you to know how suffered our people are. Every year, the sea almost takes away 1 to 2 meters of our land and emerging when this goes along for 50, 60 years. I guess there is no Tuvalu anymore. There is no country called Tuvalu anymore. If we still commit ourselves to pollute the atmosphere. And we are here to kindly ask. And we are here to look for a shoulder to lean on. And my brothers and sisters from the United States, please give us a shoulder to lean on. We are suffered. And I know that we can work together to eliminate and make us free from a climate change and sea level rise. We love our cultures, we love our tradition, and we are connected to our land. As what my brothers from Kiribati and Tokelau said. And I know that you also love your land. You don't want to lose your land. You don't want to lose your culture and your tradition. Likewise, we also don't want to lose that. So please, give us a shoulder to lean on. That's all about Tuvalu, and I am pleased to answer any questions regarding Tuvalu. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have only a few minutes for this part of the program, and I'm going to be very short. I want to just say a few words on behalf of the state of California, which I represent, and also as a citizen of Los Angeles and of the United States of America. So, first of all, I should say that we are experiencing the effects of climate change here, but not to the same degree. We are obviously a much bigger country, and we're also a much richer country. We're only 2% of the emissions for the world as a whole, but we did take it upon ourselves as a state to limit our emissions. We passed a law in 2006. It was signed by the then governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, which pledged that California as a state would reduce its emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. That's the same target that the other countries of the world who signed the Kyoto Treaty agreed to. And under Governor Brown, we are fulfilling that commitment. We are taking steps so that by the end of 2011, we will have put on our books laws and regulations that will eliminate all of the emissions that are needed to get us to that 2020 goal. The major source of our effort has been our work with cars. We have worked to make the new cars that are sold in our state meet much stricter levels of emissions of greenhouse gases. We've also worked to make our fuels cleaner, to change the fuels that we use for both driving our vehicles and also for our electrical system. And California, for many years, even before we took on the goal of trying to deal with the threat of climate change, or at least to begin to deal with it, also was becoming the most energy efficient state in the United States, so that we use less energy per person than any other state in the country, even though we are a very large state. But having said all of that, of course, what we do here is not going to stop the onward march of climate change, the buildup of gases. And we, too, are frustrated when we go to Washington or when we listen to what's happening in our nation's capital, because it would seem if you just listen to the news media or watch Fox television that people don't believe in climate change, they don't think it's real, or if it's real, people didn't cause it, or if people caused it, there's nothing you can do about it that won't cause our country to become very poor and go backwards economically. So there's a huge debate going on politically about this issue. And I would say that at the moment, people who care about this issue and who want to work on it feel very discouraged because they don't see that they are winning when it comes to the elections process or to choosing people who will represent the kinds of views that you are talking about. I would like to say, though, that I think that's maybe only a superficial view or maybe only a temporary view, because the reality is that as climate change becomes more apparent in this country, and we will be hearing more about this later from the scientists, in terms of the extreme weather events that we are already seeing even in our own country, people maybe won't want to face up to it, but they will recognize that there are things that have to change, and that we are going to need, even as a very rich country, we will not be able to protect ourselves completely. We can't just build walls or pump more water from underneath the earth. So we will, I think, be moving more in the direction where people will realize that what you are bringing to us is something that we should have listened to, that we should listen to. I want to particularly, though, comment on the fact that you're bringing not only your words, but you're bringing us also the testimony of your lives and of your art. And you're expressing what you're facing and your concerns in a way that we're not really used to. This is not political. When you see dance, when you see hear singing, when you see the pictures and hear people talking about their culture, this is not what we're used to discussing when we talk about climate change. And maybe part of the problem that we've had in this country is that for most people, climate change is something very remote, very distant, very far away, maybe something that their grandchildren might possibly have to deal with, but not them. Well, I happen to have a grandchild, so maybe I'm a little more focused on thinking about what her life will be like. But I'm curious, and any one of you can answer this question, really, how did you decide to come and to bring the kind of performance that you're doing here to the American people? What made you take to this course? How did this idea come about? Do you?
You, okay. Well, this is not my first trip about climate change. I attended the Indigenous People for Climate Change, the first Indigenous meeting in Alaska for the Indigenous People Declaration, and also in Australia and in Rarotonga. So going to these meetings is sitting down, discussions going on, and you don't really feel that someone is doing something to actually protect your people. So you think of it, what can I do as a non-scientist or just a dancer or just a citizen? What can you do to actually help your people? When I heard about the project, luckily and thankfully that I heard about the project, I woke up and could not go to sleep. I said, this is the chance. I am very proud of my culture, I'm very proud of my identity. I'm very proud of my land. So that's the reason why I use my dance, and I'm sure that goes to Kiripassi and also brothers from Tuvalu. We use these talents and this culture that we have, this so unique culture, to bring out our human face, to show you that these are the people that is just another human being. I know that the whole world is affected by climate change. We are very aware of it. Even your next door in Alaska, in Yakutat, is even gone. And I feel for those people. When I met those people, just the thought of losing your land is like a nightmare. So thank you again, Judy, and thank you to you all for coming here and give us your ears, give us your presence, and I hope that our dance and our testimonials to the effect of climate change have made you think more than just listening to the television and some people there thinking that the scientists are just making up, getting more money to do what they like, and so on and so on. No, it's real. It's really, really real.
I have one more question before we then turn the program back to the dancers. And that has to do with the role of dance in your culture. You've brought us a group of very talented people, and obviously they perform, they've rehearsed together, they perform as a group, their voices blend together, you can see them dancing together as a group. So is this something you do at home? Is this something you do all the time? Is it something that you do for just for your own pleasure, or is it something you only do for sacred, you know, for religious purposes? How does the dance fit in with your life when you're at home?
No, we just do the dance when during a feast time and. But not usually at home. We didn't back home. We didn't dance at home. Just for special events like the feast and in church. No, not really. Yes.
And is this something that people are trained to do from a very early age as children, or only grown-ups? How does that?
Yes, yeah. You know, in my country, when you're a little kid, your parents used to teach you how to dance, because when you get older and when you reach the When you dance beautifully, it means that your parents cared for you. They really care for you. That's what it means when you dance beautifully. In my country, that's in my country. Yeah.
That's great. Okay. Thank you. I think we shall now move this table away and see the dancers again. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Paul Bungie. I work in the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability here as well. And I'm incredibly pleased to have such a wonderful group here because it's very often difficult for us to look at climate change through more than one set of eyes. And we often think of it as science merely, but as was so eloquently stated during the last panel, it's more than just about the facts. It's also about what we know about those facts, how we feel about them, how we value and judge those things. Is it a good or a bad thing at its very core? And then beyond that, what do we do about it? And so I think the folks that we have here representing can really do an excellent job describing that. And you've already met Chairman Nichols, who, besides being chairman of the Air Resources Board, is also proudly still a professor here at UCLA in the Institute of the Environment and in the law school. And so we'll have her put on her professor hat, too. Next to her is Alex Hall, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, a climate scientist, and doing some of the world's most cutting-edge research on understanding what climate change means for very local places, much like the islands, but also here in Los Angeles. Next to him is Professor Paul Barber in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, an expert in marine biodiversity and marine processes, particularly in areas of the Pacific Ocean, such as we're discussing today. Next to Paul is Professor Elizabeth DeLogri, who's in the Department of English, also Vice Chancellor of Undergraduate Students here at UCLA, and is an expert and teaches often in issues of post-colonial literature, particularly with an emphasis on Pacific Islands. And then we've all met Michaela Maeva, I hope I'm getting that right, from Tokelau, and we're very, very, very glad that you joined us again here. Given this whole set of issues, I'd like to ask each of you to describe how it is that we can understand or study climate change through the eyes of your own particular discipline, and how that might give us, might lend us to a greater, more full or holistic understanding of some of these issues. And maybe I'll ask Alex to start.
Thanks, Paul. Yes. Well, I guess the thing that I'm really struck by in watching these dancers is how interconnected we all are culturally, but it also there's a strong parallel in the Earth system, and the issue of sea level rise I think is a great illustration of how interconnected the Earth system really is. We've seen sea level rise over the past century of something like 20 centimeters or about 8 inches, and that sea level rise is projected to accelerate significantly over the coming century. About half that comes from the melting of the mountain glaciers and the ice sheets, and another half of that comes from rising sea levels due to expansion of the water as it gets warmer. And in both of those processes, there's enormous complexity and enormous interconnection among different elements of the Earth system. So there's a need to really understand the Earth very holistically to address this particular issue. And I think that is paralleled by our need to develop a cultural understanding of the dimensions of this problem as well. And, you know, as scientists, we focus a lot on the uncertainties, and there are major uncertainties associated with sea level rise, in particular the behavior of these giant ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica. It's a little bit ironic that the areas that are most responsible for sea level rise from a physical sense are so remote from the areas that are so affected, although there definitely are cultural effects associated with the melting of these ice sheets. Also, there are indigenous peoples in the high latitudes that are affected as well, so there are cultural parallels to be taken into account. So we're very busy as scientists trying to understand how these ice sheets are behaving, how they respond to climate change, and how their mass balance will change in the future. And this is something that we're very, very keen on understanding better, because that's a huge uncertainty in how much sea level rise we'll actually have. And I guess finally, I was just really struck as I was watching these dancers by how irrelevant the science seems. You know, I was thinking about what I would say up here, and I was thinking, what could I say that would be more powerful and eloquent than what we just saw? I really wish that I could do my own dance to illustrate all these points. I just, yeah. No, I didn't. My parents, I'm sure they would believe that I'm very well brought up, but they did not teach me how to dance.
We offer classes.
Yeah, thank you. So I think the new PowerPoint surely has to be dancing. So I really, you know, I think the you know, science is obviously a very powerful tool and very necessary. But for climate change, what we really need, what the bottleneck is putting a human face on it, understanding it from a human perspective. That's what people ultimately respond to. People don't care about facts about nature. Scientists care a lot, but people really don't. And this is very necessary, I think, for us to persuade the world that climate change is important, because I don't think people really are listening to the scientists, and I don't think that we are the ones who have the ability to carry the message forward. So I really applaud this effort today.
Paul Barber, this has myriad effects on these ecosystems and on these cultures.
Yeah, it does. And some of the processes that Alex was talking about, if you read the news, if you listen to politicians, there's in some ways a false debate that's created. People talk about the fact that these are, they're natural processes, and to some degree that, that is true. 18,000 years ago, sea level was 130 meters lower than it is today. Sea levels rise and fall over time. Islands emerge from the ocean and they subside as the geological processes that create them give way to the geological processes that erode them and bring them back to the sea. And so there's a temptation to say this is all natural. And because it's all natural, what can we do about it? But the reality of the situation is that, these natural processes occur slowly over, periods of thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of years. And what's happened in recent time is the rate of change has increased dramatically. And, the rate of sea level rise, the rate of warming of the ocean is occurring at unprecedented rates. And that's something that, is a direct result of, the way that we've used fossil fuels since the Industrial Revolution. I think there's also a temptation for people to think, these are small atolls in the middle of the Pacific. Listening to, the three of you speak, we can see the personal tragedy that this represents. But a lot of people still, might drive home today and say, well, how does that affect me? And what's, I think, the real value of this program here today is that, we're listening to the canaries in the coal mine. What they're telling us here now about, what may be their fate is, maybe it's a matter of time before these processes start to affect us. And, we're not going to lose our land, but because, our country is so large. But if you think about the other impacts that global warming is having in marine environments, these are going to impact us. And other countries around the world. So elevated CO2 levels are correlated with elevated sea level temperatures. When coral reefs experience water temperatures about 1 degree centigrade warmer than their average summer maximum, they begin to bleach. They turn white. So that white color back there, that's not the natural color of the coral. That's a coral dying because it's saying this water's too warm. We can't survive. There's many, you know, there's states like Hawaii, you know, in the U.S. There are countries all throughout the world in the Caribbean and Southeast Asia that depend upon healthy coral reefs, and they're dying and disappearing because of the effects of climate change. And that has a major impact on local food security as well as the economies of these countries. If you think about fisheries, we heard about tuna. When CO2 levels increase, when you combine carbon dioxide with water, you get a mild acid called carbonic acid, and the sea can absorb a certain amount of there's a certain amount of buffering ability of seawater, but eventually you get lowered pHs. And what these are skeletons of phytoplankton. And on the top, you see phytoplankton at normal CO2 levels. And these are the same phytoplankton at lowered pH, at elevated CO2. They're not healthy. When they're not healthy, they don't grow as fast. If you don't have as many phytoplankton, you don't have as many zooplankton. Those zooplankton feed the small fish. The small fish feed the big fish. And so when you have lowered pHs, reducing the productivity of the oceans, you impact your fisheries. And so you have decreased fishery yields, and that, you know, that impacts all nations that have significant fishing fleets. And it's not just the productivity issues, but, you know, these, as water temperatures change, the fish that we target change ranges. In some places, you know, they move out of the areas where they're traditionally fished. In some cases, you know, the conditions change so much that they're gone. So it's something that's going to impact all nations, not just these three.
Liz DeLogri, that fits right in with your perspective of how we can understand this also through art and literature in particular.
So I've been asked, can you hear me okay? So I've been asked to highlight the contributions of the arts and humanities. I had a lot of material I wanted to cover, so I have a text. So the value of the arts, I think, can be found in terms of garnering a visceral, an aesthetic, and an emotional response in creating awareness, inspiring creativity, and in sharing knowledge about the human experience. If modernity creates a sense of alienation from nature, an encounter with art often creates a sense of wonder. We may feel re-enchantment with the world, and by extension may be catalyzed into a sense of urgency and towards social and political change. From my perspective in literature, the very language in which we use to discuss the causes and consequences of climate change matters. We make sense of our being in the world through language. It connects us to our communities, and it reflects our knowledge systems. Thus, when we use the term virgin nature, for example, we imagine something outside of the human that can be controlled, dominated, raped, which positions the human as agent and nature as victim. When we speak of Mother Earth, our role changes. We become subordinate to an omniscient world of nature in which we are not all-knowing. This shifts from the language of domination and managing to one of family and of mutual recognition. Our language about the rising sea highlights this feeling of the immensity of a nature that cannot be fully imagined or controlled, even as we recognize our own contributions to climate change. Since the focus here is on water, I want to draw from an inspiring visionary of the Pacific, the Tongan anthropologist Epele Ho'ofa, who in the early 1990s critiqued Western assumptions that the Pacific Islands are impossibly remote. He wrote, "There is a world of difference between viewing the Pacific as islands in a far sea and as a sea of islands. The first emphasizes dry surfaces in a vast ocean far from the centers of power, stressing the smallness and remoteness. The second is a more holistic perspective in which things are seen in the totality of their relationships. Shifting to the language of ocean peoples, which also reflects a shift in how one relates to the environment, catalyzed the establishment of the Oceania Center for the Arts and Culture in 1997 in Fiji, a locus for artistic work expressing the diversity of contemporary indigenous art forms across the region. I think I need that slide projector. Oh, there we go. So the slides you'll see in the background are from my visit to the center last year to attend the Oceanic Conference on Creativity and Climate Change, Oceans, Islands, and Skies. The Oceania Center, is it this one? Okay. Is a place literally without walls. Unlike most educational institutions that require fees and forms, the center is open to all and is an open space in which people work closely and within sight of each other and whose events are always free. This encourages collaboration between the artists of the region, participation of those who may not otherwise have the economic means, and highlights two themes that are vital to our workshop today. Ahofa states, quote, "The creativity unleashed should reflect important principles of our societies, in particular reciprocity, cooperation, openness to community, and transmission of knowledge and skills. In the modern world, art is considered an individual's affair. We, however, view art from the interest of a collective and encourage our artists to nurture each other. Second, we aim to harness creativity to our practical struggle for survival. In Oceania, all forms of creativity were integral to the daily life of the community. There was no such thing as art for its own sake. The best way for the Oceania Center to do this is to tie the arts to the most urgent need for protecting our ocean resources. This should enable us to remain true to the tenets of our communities and to contribute significantly to the protection of the forests and the oceans for the continuity of life on Earth. Hofa's vision of the ocean is built upon a foundation of reciprocity and also accountability. The ocean that has been our waterway to each other should also be our route to the rest of the world, he says. By extension, this means that the rest of the world, particularly North Americans, are tied in concrete and accountable ways to the Pacific. In this vision, the islands are not distant lands in a far sea, but are part of a world ocean that we share, and frankly, whose pollution, overfishing, nuclear waste testing and dumping, and carbon colonialism is directly tied to North America. These artworks from the center reflect different perspectives about the threat of climate change. From the representation of climate refugees to the educational postcards that focus on the consumption of styrofoam. Well, these are children who participated in the conference. So from the representation of climate refugees to the educational postcards that focus on the consumption of styrofoam and also of plastic water bottles. These artists are helping make visible the repercussions of our participation in environmental crisis. Oops. This last postcard reminds us that Pacific contributions to greenhouse gas emissions are less than 1%, and by that figure it includes New Zealand, and yet they suffer disproportionately. So the final image, and I'll conclude with this one. This is a mixed media piece by the Rotuman artist Craig Marlowe. Reflects the American Statue of Liberty, crowned by a discarded hubcap, surrounded by signs of capitalist consumption, all the currency that you see worked into the art piece, and permeated by symbols of militarism and of plastic, icons of death, disposability, and destruction. The icons of hope in this piece are plastic flowers. This is not the work of an isolated artist in a far sea, but one whose vision, from a sea of islands, provides a startling but, I think, instructive critique of how, as Ho'ofa noted, the sea is our pathway to each other and to everyone else. It speaks of the interconnecting flow between this continent and its global contribution to climate crisis. Thank you.
Michele, I'm struck by how you've influenced, how all of you have influenced even the thoughts that our scholars here have had. Through your dance, through your song, and through your message, what do you think you can do to help us better help you, either through our studies or through the ways we can influence action? And at the end, we'll sort of turn to Mary as a way to conclude that thought.
as we all know, two parts of doing something about climate change, one of adaptation and mitigation. Well, you all know that you heard from Tuvalu, we contribute to 0.00000 of emissions to the air. In Tokelau, Tokelau National Strategic Plan 2010-2013, we're helping the world for Tokelau to become the first nation to depend on renewable energy only, solar power and wind power. That's how we help you. So how can you help me? You want to write a check right now? So those are the programs and the project that are very serious. We are very serious about climate change, and we're doing everything that we can to help the world. In adaptation, we're planting more trees in this small island, an island that the land is taken away from this water is rising. We're doing our best in adaptation project. We're doing our best to build seawalls. Tangaloa there, and Mateo over there, Savelio, they are all dedicating to building their seawalls just to hold the land. And holding the lands means we can plant trees. We cannot plant trees when your land is not there. So these are the things that we are very serious about. We're very serious in dedicating ourselves in helping the world. Now, what can you do then to help us?
And I'll let Mary Nichols conclude that, but particularly referencing what you've heard a couple of times, you all are showing us our own future. So what is it that we can do not only to help our brothers and sisters in Tokelau and Kiribati and Tuvalu, but to help ourselves and our children, as you've already eloquently described?
So I have a couple of reactions to that. The first is that the scale of what's involved for helping ourselves in our own land, of course, is much huger because the land is larger, the population is larger, and the size of the problem and the size of the money that it will take to deal with it is much, much larger. We are starting to look at issues about adaptation, and the costs are staggering. We're talking about, because of sea level rise that's already occurring, a need to armor areas of our coast that have never been armored before. We're talking about losing wetlands, which we have painfully purchased in many cases from private owners and helped to restore, which are facing inundation. We're talking about billions of dollars. I think the estimate I saw was $14 billion for restoration of levees, which will become useless. That hold back the water from flooding, the water that comes down from the mountains in the snow melt and could inundate the city of Sacramento, and has at various times in the past, from destroying all of that property, and hundreds of billions of dollars in potential loss of property, not only public infrastructure like roads or treatment plants for water and sewage, which are facing extinction, but also homes of people who live along the coast as well. So maybe if the science won't convince people that it's time to start moving, the economics will convince them that if we don't start now, it's going to just get more expensive as time goes on. And so it's worthwhile investing something now, both on the protection side and on the mitigation side. And some of it is both. For example, our electricity system, if we have large coastal power plants sitting right on the edge of the ocean, and they're generating electricity through burning fossil fuels, those plants are at risk from sea level rise and climate change and from catastrophic events like storm surges and tidal waves. But they're also helping to continue to create the problem. So when we as a society think about where to build the next power plants or how to invest, let's think about investing in the alternatives for our own sake, as well as for the people of the Pacific Islands. The other thought I have is quite different, and it reflects back to the cultural aspects of all of this. I think one of the things that maybe in academia we're too polite to talk about or think may not be appropriate to talk about is the fact that the music that was being presented to us is a form of sacred music. We are here as a part of a world sacred music festival. It happens by chance. I was at another event that's part of this festival a few days ago, sitting in a large Gothic church listening to a wonderful organ play music of Bach and other Western composers. Here I'm at a different end of town in a very different facility, but it's also a form of sacred music. And we shouldn't be afraid to touch people, not only in their emotions, which are, you know, obviously the way we respond to the arts aesthetically, but also I think in that part of human beings, including those in our own country who are in decision-making positions, many of whom, if not most of whom, think of themselves as being religious people, I think it's okay to talk to them in those kinds of terms as well. And that's part of what this music does. But
I couldn't have said it better myself, I think. And by way of that, I think I would like to take a moderator's privilege and thank you all for coming here and doing something that was remarked to me by one of the panelists. We don't often, as academics, get a chance to come together and look at something like climate change through all of these different eyes, be they science or art or spirituality and religion. And so thank you for enriching our environments as well and reminding us, as Chairman Nichols said, California is really trying and reminding us, frankly, why we're doing it and why it's so important. So thank you. And we now get questions from the audience, which is even better. And I'm going to invite Madeline Glickfeld and Judy Matoma back again to moderate. But thank you all very much.
Thank you. And I just want to give you all an opportunity. This is an extraordinary opportunity to ask your own questions of the audience. Do I see a question up there? Somebody can be brave enough to ask the first. Yes, you could. Yes, sir. Could you speak up a little bit? I'd like to have each of you talk about that. Why is science losing the conversation in the United States? Who wants to take that?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that we're the best ones to answer that question, just because we don't think that way, I don't think. But, you know, scientists don't think in those terms. But I think that, you know, there are a couple of dynamics. One is that it's an incredibly complex issue, it's one that's filled with uncertainties. I alluded to a couple of them in the context of sea level rise. And I think that democratic discourse doesn't necessarily lend itself to complexity. And so it's hard to talk about climate change in the way that we're used to talking about it, which is having two people in a room who seem to be on different sides of the political aisle have a discussion. And I think the other factor is more subtle. I think it's a very scary prospect. I think it's you know, the idea of that humans are having this profound influence on the environment is hard for people to process. And I think that sometimes people just decide that they're not going to process it, and they just deny that it exists. I think there's an element of that as well. But I think other people may have more to say on this issue than
I do.
So
I want to ask you, though, one of the things, last night we had a lecture by Dr. Carnesell, and he said the dilemma is that scientists cannot say they're unequivocally sure what's going to happen and when it's going to happen. And scientists are very careful to say, we think that this is going to happen. And the discussion becomes one of, well, if they think it, they don't know it. So how do we get past that kind of a dilemma?
I mean, it's, you know, the analogy that I like to bring up is the one to medicine, because I think that's where people face decisions that are informed by uncertainty all the time. I think when people have a diagnosis, for example, of cancer, there are all kinds of treatment decisions that you can pursue, and it's not clear which one is going to work the best, and yet you still have to make a decision. We make decisions under uncertainty all the time, and we have to. And I think that for some reason, maybe the question is, why don't we? when it comes to climate change, why are we comfortable saying that because we are uncertain about it or because we don't know the truth precisely, we are going to do nothing? That's actually the opposite of how we behave in the rest of our lives.
Any other comments about what we can do to make the scientific argument stronger? Or maybe the scientist is not the right spokesman. What would any of you like to comment on that?
I guess my comment would be is that, you know, we don't have scientists saying we don't have 100% certainty, so we're not going to do anything. What's happening, I think, is that because, you know, we can't say we don't have 100% certainty, that is used in the media and political arenas as a justification for inaction. And so I think that the question really becomes, how do we get our politicians and our society to accept the fact that, as all humankind, you know, we have this diagnosis and we have to do something. And, there are a variety of potential outcomes, and some which are more likely than others, and that's what the science tells us. And just like if you had the analogy with cancer, you're going to use that information, and you could say, I have cancer, maybe I'll get over it, I'm going to do nothing. But that'd be a very small percentage of people, whereas I think society and most global governments have made the decision, well, we don't really know, so we're not really going to engage in any sort of treatment yet. And I think that's where the real disconnect is. I don't think the scientists are saying we shouldn't do anything because we don't know for certain. It's how the science is being interpreted. And as a scientist, I don't know how to control how people interpret my work. That's a challenge.
I think you're hitting you hit right onto the dilemma. Is there another question in the audience? Right on the second row? Could you stand up and speak, please? Yes.
Okay, my first question is, as far as the CO2 and the problem with the ocean, cannot scientists do some research and introduce some kind of enzyme or something to try to reverse the effects of what's happening negatively in the world's ocean?
Yeah.
For number one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you fix it?
I can't fix it. You know, this brings up a really interesting topic, which is a subject of very intense debate among scientists, which is whether we should be thinking about geoengineering and whether we should be thinking about technological solutions to climate change, whether it's putting aerosols in the stratosphere to try to reflect sunlight or introducing nutrients into the surface ocean so that they will take up more carbon from the atmosphere as the plants grow in the ocean. There are all kinds of proposals that are out there, and they are being seriously investigated in the scientific community. But then this gets into questions about their ethical questions, and I think you can't divorce those from the scientific debate. So this is an area where there's a very rich discourse, I think, between scientists and philosophers and spiritual leaders about how we manage our relationship with the planet, and those are very tough questions.
Can we turn the oceans back to acidic rather than alkaline?
No. It's simply too large. Some of the things that Alex just mentioned, this adding nutrients to the ocean is an idea that people are playing with, that it'll help take up carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and essentially move it from the atmosphere and sequester it down in the ocean floor in terms of precipitated carbon. So, you know, that might work, but there are lots of issues associated with that.
Michael. Coming from a very small island, you depend on information. Information that you understand of what is going on. And to me, information that we get from the scientists is, I agree, it's all about how you understand. And it's all about what you want to do about it. Here we are in Tokelau, we know, and then we listen and we hear all the data and statistics about climate change, and we're doing something about it. We're mitigating. We're adapting. We're doing something about it. Talking about geoengineering, this is something that I think is going to be a chaos, thinking of geoengineering, putting more chemicals in the cloud to absorb more CO2, putting these different chemicals in the sea to absorb less CO2. You are actually doing something that is not good for Mother Earth. And we appreciate, I'm not, you know, want to be the good guy here to the scientists, but we do appreciate the scientist information that we gather, and we think to ourselves, as me as an indigenous and as me as a person from the small island that is sinking, I think it makes sense to me.
One more question. Is there anyone in the back? The man in the plaid shirt, would you come down a little bit so that we can give you the microphone? Can you come to the side? Thank you for your question. Who wants to respond?
I think something must be done, and it should start here. I mean, I think some of the, it's interesting, the discussion as we keep turning to science, hoping to answer our questions, and you know, science, like all fields, is limited, and there are ways that we know what's happening. We know what we need to do. We know we have to limit our consumption. We know that we have to, you know, eat locally. We know that we should be on the bus instead of in our SUVs going out to wilderness areas, right? I mean, we know the patterns that North Americans have of consumption. You know, the elephant in the room is capitalism. These are things, discussions we need to have. So I think it's really problematic for a country that has done so much to pollute the rest of the world to then turn around and say, oh, the rest of you need to limit your birth, right? I mean, you know, these are questions. I mean, these are questions about sovereignty, about access to resources that are far more complicated than just something as simple, I think, as population, right? I mean, there, you know, you may have a population. What is it that population's impact on the environment? You know, it's actually surprising to me to hear that California is 2% of world's global warming. I mean, their contribution. That's an enormous amount, actually. I mean, I'm glad there are many progressive movements in California to address this, but that's just an enormous amount. So I feel like, you know, we need to start thinking here first before prescribing behaviors elsewhere.
I just want to add, I thank you, Elizabeth. I agree with your comments. I would just add, you know, as a representative of the Institute of Environment and Sustainability, I want to focus on the question of what sustainability means, because the definition is one in which everybody who is alive is able to enjoy the same standard of living without necessarily consuming as much of the Earth's resources so that we can reach some sort of a steady state. We don't know if that's actually possible, but what we do know is that in the United States and in Western Europe, which are the two major contributors and causers of the current levels of global warming that we're facing today, the population is not growing. We're aging populations, and we're dependent on immigrants to run our economy. We're in a frozen state in many respects. And so I think this issue of demographics and who is entitled to grow and who isn't entitled to grow is very tied up with the issue of use of resources and the burden that we're putting collectively on the planet. As I understand the problem that we're facing in terms of mitigation, it is incumbent on us to help parts of the world that have yet to achieve anything close to the standard of living that we have and that want to achieve greater prosperity to do that without causing the kinds of problems that we caused ourselves. That's our obligation, and that's why all the international discussions about this problem involve not only cutting emissions from the developed world, but also direct assistance to the developing nations of the world to help them achieve those goals. Because we know that when people realize that they can enjoy a higher standard of living through not having large families, that is exactly what they do. When you empower people to realize their dreams through education and through opportunity, then you start to see negative population growth.
Thank you very much. That concludes this panel. I want to thank you all for coming today. And we're going to have our final closing dance. Please don't leave, because this is going to be the best. And with the panel after we conclude, we're all asking everyone to go downstairs to where there's going to be a meet and greet and a little reception, and there'll be the press to talk to there. Thank you.
I want to, on my behalf of our program, the UCLA Center for Intercultural Performance and the Department of World Arts and Cultures, I want to thank everybody who took the time to come today and to prepare your remarks for this panel. Our program here, our residency of Water is Rising, actually we are about halfway through this. We attended two classes yesterday in the environmental classes. Most of them were freshmen. It was very exciting for our artists to be with them. We had a Time and Tide film screening with Melnitz Movies last night. This panel is our fourth activity. Tomorrow we'll be doing a concert for over 1,000 children. And these children have been instructed to refer to our educational website, and I hope you will have a moment to look at it as well, www.waterisrising.com. We have put a great deal of energy and worked in cooperation with the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability make this happen. And for us, it was really fun to be able to have a strong climate change science section, a cultural section, and an arts section in this one website, waterisrising.com. Finally, before our last delegation from Tokelau take the stage and conclude our program, I want you all to know that the premiere of their concert will happen Saturday night, 7 o'clock, at Royce Hall. This is the benefit concert for the World Festival of Sacred Music, and it is the first time they will be in front of an audience like ours. Even today, I could feel how, you know, performing for you was really special, and a new discovery of their agency as individuals and as performers. So please spread the word, help us. We are a grassroots organization. We do not have deep advertising pockets. There is brochures there and pamphlets about our show on Saturday night. We would break my heart to have any empty seat when they have traveled from so far to share so much with us. So that's Saturday, 7 o'clock at Royce Hall, Water is Rising. Now, I also, as the last delegation, Tokelau, come, I want to tell you, the remoteness of these islands also is about Tokelau being far away. And for me, to actually get to Tokelau was a personal accomplishment, I have to say. Because not only, you know there's a boat that goes there, and 20 years ago I heard it only went once a month, And the interesting thing, it's still true today. The boat goes once a month, but you're never sure when it's going to leave. So on faith, I went to Apia, Samoa, and waited for that boat to Tokelau. And by good fortune, I met Mika, who leads this group and who put together something really remarkable in very short order. I'm very grateful to him and the entire delegation who traveled from so far. We are going to conclude our program with the delegation from Tokelau.
Thank you.
Been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.